First of all, do I need to fast? Meaning that who are those people who need to fast? Who are the people who are exempted from fasting? Who are those who need to fast? And if it's the case that I'm not fasting for whatever reason, are there any consequences? The second thing we want to cover, inshallah, is when do I fast? When is meaning issues relating to the sighting of the moon and also relating to the starting and stopping of fasting in a particular day within the month of Ramadan. And then we'll cover how should I fast? What are those things that I need to stay away from? And then, inshallah, what are the consequences of not fasting? If somebody were to, for whatever reason, sin and not fast when they had to fast, what are the consequences of not doing so? Okay, I hope that people are able to see the screen. If there are any issues, please do comment. Okay, the sources for this presentation, the focus in this presentation is to present these laws according to the teachings of and the fatawa, the legal opinions of Ayatollah Sistani and Ayatollah Khamenei. And the source for this presentation is logically and naturally speaking, their books, for example, Minhaj al-Salihin and some of the books of Ayatollah Khamenei, as well as the question and answers on their websites. I do have references for all the points that I will be presenting, so if there's any issues that come up and you need to get those references, please do ask me during the question and answer time at the end, or you can send me an email at any time. Inshallah, I can provide you with the references as well too. Okay, the first topic we want to cover is, do I need to fast? Who is it that this obligation applies to, and who is it that are exempted? First of all, it's good for us to step back and understand, why is it that fasting is an obligation? I mean, those of us who have the fortune to be born as Muslims, we just take fasting as something which is, kind of granted. When month Ramadan comes along, we have to fast. But it's good for us to just step back and understand why this is the case. If you look at the Quran has the ayahs that I presented here, where Allah mentions that fasting is an obligation. كُتِبَ عَلَيْكُمُ أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ كُتِبَ عَلَيْكُمُ الصِّيَامُ كَمَا كُتِبَ عَلَى الَّذِينَ مِنْ قَبْلِكُمْ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ. It is something which is prescribed for you. It is something which is obligatory. And then in the two verses after that in Surah Baqarah, Allah says, those of you who witness the month of Ramadan, if you're there and the first of the month arrives, the crescent moon is sighted, then fast in this month. And that indicates something which is an obligation. And in a number of ahadith, we're told, the Ahlul Bayt inform us, what are the foundations of the deen? What are the pillars of the religion? And in this particular tradition from Imam Al-Baqir alayhi salam, we're told that Islam is founded upon five: Salat, Zakat, Hajj, Sawm, and Walaya. Meaning that these five actions and the beliefs that are tied to them are so fundamental to the deen that that they're considered the foundation upon which everything else is built. And if you look at this, we can examine this on both an individual level and a societal level. On an individual level, for an individual who wants to enjoy the blessings of Islam and be able to partake in Islam in its fullest sense, he or she has to be engaged in all these obligations. Salat, meaning the personal relationship with Allah, that ibadah. Zakat, meaning our attention that we have to others and how we relate to them. The Hajj, the opportunity for a rebirth. The Sawm, which is an opportunity for us to show our dedication to Allah, to pull away from the dunya and to feel for the poor, and to be able to sympathize with them and help them as well. And Walaya, which ties all of these together refers to our relationship that we have with the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. On a societal level, all of these are very important as well. And in an Islamic society, all of these need to be present in order for the society to function. Salat needs to be there, and that provides a daily regular opportunity for mu'mineen and muslimin to get and gather together in congregation. Zakat needs to be there as a way of enabling the society to function and for the rich to be helping out with the poor and for there to be equity and justice in the society. Hajj needs to be there as a gathering point that will happen once a year. And the Sawm needs, the fasting needs to be there in order to regulate the members of the society. Meaning that when we have Sawm, when we have fasting, it's an opportunity for the entire society, Islamic society, to engage in this act. And as a whole, it will lead to the curbing of the shahwa and for the entire society to be focused and inwardly and on the relationship with Allah. And so it's a necessary thing for the society, for rectifying the evils of the society. And walaya, of course, referring to the leadership in the society. Now, I've been informed that some people cannot see the slides. Is that the case? Okay, so one brother says he can see just fine. Anybody else? Okay, so for the most, some of you can see, some of you cannot see. Okay. So I don't have an alternative to what we're doing right now. Okay, so for the most part, people can see the slides. If you can't see the slide, perhaps there's an issue with your internet connection. You'll have to suffice with the audio. Okay, let me go back to presenting the slides then. Okay, great. Now, okay, alhamdulillah, so people are able to see. Now, this is an obligation. We talked a little bit about the wisdom behind this obligation. That itself is a different topic. Our focus is on the laws. But I just hinted at it in terms of what's there for both an individual and for the Islamic society as a whole and how important it is for that. Now let's talk about it from a legal perspective. Fasting is an obligation. The Quran says, "Kutiba alaykum as-siyam." This is something which is prescribed from you. But does it apply to every single person no matter what? No. There's some conditions that need to be in place in order for it to be compulsory. First of all, somebody has to be mukallaf, meaning that they have to have they have to be capable of receiving taklif and responsibility and commands and prohibitions from God. That means that they have to be, number one, sane and to be able to be capable of receiving that taklif, and also baligh as well too. They have to have become of age. And in terms of what it takes to be to be of age for a according to the maraja that we're speaking of, their legal opinions, for a lady, for a girl, it's the completion of 9 lunar years, meaning that she now turns 9 years old according to the lunar calendar. And in terms of a boy, there's one of 3 signs that have to be in place, one or more than one. As soon as one of the 3 signs takes place, then he would become of age. One of them is that he would reach 15 years old. Another one would be the growth of pubic hair. And the third one would be basically ejaculation and the emission of seminal fluid. Okay, the next condition is that somebody should not be traveling. And that has that needs to be discussed in more detail. What does it mean to be traveling and not? And who are those who are exempted even though they are traveling? More details about that later, inshallah. For women only, they have to be clean from hayd and nifas, meaning that if a woman were to see the blood of one of these, like for example, if she were to see the blood of her cycle, even for 1 second of the day, like right before the Maghrib time, then that it would not be something, the fasting would not be compulsory on her and she would not be able to fast for that day. Another condition is that one has to not be ill, not be sick, and that has some more explanation as well to where is the point that we can say that okay, it's okay for us not to fast, or where it's not valid for us to fast. That will be explained later, inshallah. Another one is the ability to keep the fast, meaning that there's some people who aren't able to fast, and that will also be explained later. And there's some other rare conditions as well too that are mentioned in the books. I tried to choose that which is most relevant to the vast majority of us. Okay, now, as far as a non-baligh child is concerned, this is an issue that we come up with in various communities. There's either an emphasis or lack of emphasis on this issue, where it is something that is made an issue or not, meaning that are children encouraged to fast or not. Now, when we go to the hadith of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, we see one hadith, for example, from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. He says that at the age of 7, we ask our children to fast to their capability, meaning the children of the Ahlul Bayt, either half of the day or more or less, and we order them to break their fast when they become hungry or thirsty. This is so that they become used to fasting. Thus, you should ask your male children to fast at the age of 9 and tell them to break their fast when they are thirsty or hungry. Now, this is very important because we need to take the Ahlul Bayt as our guide in all matters. They are the ones who set the standards for us. Even when it comes to determining what's mustahab and not mustahab, sometimes we see that parents go a little bit extreme in this regard, and they ask their children and they expect their children to fast even younger than what the Ahlul Bayt specify. Now here in this hadith we're told that that male children should be asked at 9, maybe female children maybe a couple years earlier. But even that, not that they should fast the whole day, but rather that they fast until they're hungry, and then we ask them to break their fast at that point. And this is the approach that we should be taking as a guideline when it comes to our children as well. We don't want to try to do something that's not mustahab for our children, because later on we don't know what sort of consequences it might have, and it might backfire in terms of our plan, in terms of raising our children and having them grow to love the deen and also the obligations of the deen as well. In this regard, we have to be careful not to go to the extremes. And just as sharing an anecdote, like one of my teachers, his approach was that when his children would want to fast, he would allow them to fast. But as soon as they would feel the hunger and thirst, he would tell them that they have to break their fast. And then maybe later on in the day, he would say, okay, now again, you can like fast for a few hours as well too. But it got to the point where when his son was getting older, even though it was a few years away from when he was baligh, he would not let him keep the whole fast, even though his son wanted to fast. And this is very important, because now the child is really eager to have that opportunity to be able to fast a whole day, and that will happen when he or she turns baligh, and that's the way we want it, that they're eager to take on that taklif when they turn that age. That's why we're told some of the ulama, our great ulama of the past, they would celebrate that day that they reached the age of taklif, the day that they came of age. They would celebrate that on a yearly basis, because that's the age that they were deemed as being worthy enough to receive the command of Allah. That's the way we want to try to raise our children. There's an article that's been written on this topic that has a little bit more information on it, and I've given a reference for that in the slide here. It's called Introducing Islam to Our Children, and it's on islamicinsights.com. Okay. Now, let's now go through some of the exemptions. When is it that if somebody is sane and they're baligh and the other conditions aren't, they're not traveling, they're not sick, what is some of the conditions where it's okay for them to, when are they exempted? When is it okay for them to break the fast? One of them is where somebody experiences unbearable thirst and hunger. Now, this is important because we're reaching time periods where the days are longer, and the weather is more intense, at least in the Northern Hemisphere. And for some people, this becomes an issue because they get hungry and thirsty, and it can get to the point where they become where the thirst or hunger becomes unbearable. It has extreme difficulty attached to it. If it gets to that point where somebody has reached that point where that hunger or thirst would not normally be tolerable by people in that society, or it has extreme difficulty attached to it, at that point then one can break their fast, eat the amount or drink the amount that's necessary, and then continue to refrain until sunset arrives. And in that case, then the consequence would be qada. They would have to make up that fast at another time. So I have an example here. Let's say somebody is used to eating a full meal for suhoor, but today, let's say I wasn't able to wake up for that. So am I allowed to take a rain check on today's fast, meaning that like just right then from let's say like at 5 o'clock in the morning, I realize that, oh no, I missed my alarm, I wasn't able to wake up for suhoor, so I'm definitely going to get hungry, so therefore I'm going to like break my fast because of this. Is that okay, based on what we said? Let me pose that as a question to you, see if anybody's, see if you can, inshallah, help this be interactive a little bit. Not at that moment. Yes, you have to wait until you actually experience this, the hunger. Not that you know, you just kind of like, you know, say, oh, it will happen for me for sure. Because and just experience shows that sometimes it's opposite to what we expect. Sometimes we miss the suhoor and we actually feel less hungry than we would normally. Okay. Now, another reason that would cause somebody to break. Yes, and in most cases we can fast even though we would miss the suhoor as well too. But there could be some case where some particular situation where it would lead to extreme hunger or thirst, and in that case the ruling would be applied that we talked about. Now, there's some situations where somebody, it's not about hunger or thirst, but it's about weakness, where the fasting makes somebody so weak, and that weakness would normally be considered unbearable. Okay, and that could also be a situation that would arise that the consequence there would be qada. On this chart right here, I have a little bit more detail, a flow chart. If you start on the left-hand side, you'll see that we say, okay, we'll continuing, if somebody is fasting and they're feeling weak or unbearable hunger or thirst, so on the left-hand side, we'll continuing, if meaning that continuing the fast, is that going to involve unbearable weakness or extreme difficulty? If yes, then you go down to the, and you go to the purple box, then you can eat or drink the amount necessary, refrain from eating, drinking anymore, and do qada. And then, if no, it's not that it will involve unbearable weakness or difficulty, but it will make you incapable of performing work which is essential to your livelihood. This is a matter of compulsion, where, look at, it's, if I continue this fast, then I won't be able to do this work, and it's essential that I do this work, meaning that I don't have an alternative. I'm the breadwinner for the family. I can't get another job, or I can't take time off. This is something I have to do. In that case, again, there's some allowances as well too. There is basically we're going back to the principles of extreme difficulty. Whenever Islam takes into account like extreme difficulty and unbearable hardship, and also compulsion as well too, when somebody has no other means but to do something. Okay, now another case is when we have when somebody is exempt is when they're sick and some other conditions are in place. Fasting is not obligatory, and it's also invalid. I mean, it's not going to count even if I'm sick, and if I fast, the fasting is going to cause harm to me. So what does that mean? Well, it means that like when, if you look at the second bullet point, harm can be due to when fasting will intensify my sickness, prolong my recovery, or increase the pain. So, you know, there's some situations where somebody is sick and fasting will be harmful to their health if they fast, meaning that it will cause one of these three things to take place. If this is the case, not only are they allowed to not fast, they cannot fast, meaning that it's not going to count for them, it's invalid. They should not fast that day, and they should do qada. Let me give you an example on the next slide here. Example where fasting is invalid. If somebody is, let's say I'm sick and I need to constantly drink fluids to get better. If I don't drink fluids, then I'm just going to get me worse. Now, this is a situation where my fasting is going to be invalid. I'm sick, I shouldn't fast. Other cases, no, where I have a mild cough, and fasting might keep my throat drier and prevent the cough from healing faster. Now, in that case, the harm that fasting would be cause is something that is not considerable, meaning people in the society are willing to tolerate that. You know, just if it's a mild cough and it doesn't get healed, that's not a big deal in people's eyes. The harm isn't a big deal. In that case, fasting would be valid and necessary. Now, in some cases, not only is the fast going to be not valid, not only is it going to be not necessary, but it's going to be actually haram to fast as well. Where the harm is going to be not only, I should change this actually, this is the words, where the harm is going to be serious and where it's going to be dangerous for the health. In this case, then fasting will be a sin. Now, we'll get back to this. This will be explained a little bit more in more detail on another slide about harm being considerable and it being a sin to do to fast in that situation. Now, I'm going along again. If there are any questions, please feel free to comment. Now, let's say I'm not sick, but I'm certain that if I fast, I'm going to get sick. Maybe like somebody has been pulling a bunch of all-nighters. They're not sick right now, but they know for sure that if they fast, it's going to cause them to get sick. Or it's not that they know for certain, but they have fear, and that fear is based on rational grounds. In that case, also, if I'm fear that I'll get significantly sick by fasting, then fasting is invalid in that situation as well. For example, I just recovered from an infection, meaning I'm not sick right now. I was really sick yesterday. Today is my day to recuperate. If I fast, then I fear that I won't recuperate properly and the infection will come back. And it wasn't just a minor, sniffle. It was something that was a serious infection. I had fever. It's not something that would normally be tolerated by people. In that case, even though I'm feeling okay today, I'm not allowed to fast. And my consequence will be I have to do qada. Now, another situation is where it's not about sickness, but it's about harm. Meaning that, I give an example here. Like, by fasting, I won't be able to take some heart medication at the right time, and that could in turn result in heart issues, because there's a certain time where I have to take this medication, and that's what the experts have told me. Now, in that case, I'm either certain or even I have fear that I'll be harmed by the fasting. In that case also, fasting is invalid. I'm not allowed to fast. And in some cases, it's going to be haram for me to fast as well too. Now, there's a difference of opinion here between Ayatollah Sistani and Ayatollah Khamenei. According to Ayatollah Sistani, when the harm is extreme and will not normally be tolerated, in that case, then it's haram to fast. And according to Ayatollah Khamenei, as long as there's harm, whether it's extreme or not, as long as it's considerable and it would not normally be tolerated, in that case, then it's haram for me to fast. And the consequence here is qada. Now, one thing that I'm sure you've gathered in the last few slides is that when it comes to fasting and not fasting, we have to look at, see what are my responsibility. I shouldn't be trying to be like a macho man and like just because like I think that I'm gonna ignore. Rational fear and reason and even in some cases like certainty of harm or sickness and I'm just going to go ahead and fast just because, for example, I don't want to make up the qada later. No, if the things that we mentioned are in place, then fasting is actually invalid. And so in some cases we might actually be committing a sin by fasting in those situations. On the other hand, as we'll mention shortly, if somebody is certain that fasting is not going to harm them, then they have to fast. Okay, now, what if I fast despite the fear of harm? I fear that there's going to be harm, and the fear is based on rational grounds. It's not just like some, whim, like, I felt the winds, or I read my horoscope, and I thought that, okay, this is going to be harmful for me. No, it's based on something reasonable, rational. In that case, then, if there's harm, and the harm is extreme according to Ayatollah Sistani, or just in general, if there's harm according to Ayatollah Khamenei, then I've sinned and the fast is invalid. Meaning that even if I keep the fast and I go through the whole day, I refrain from all those things, then still the fast is not going to be valid. I'll have to make up the fast later on. But if it turns out that I was okay and I wasn't harmed by this fast, then the fast is valid. Now, what about the doctor's opinion? What we said is that if I have certainty of harm or of getting sick or of my sickness getting prolonged, for example, or if I have fear based on rational grounds, meaning that I'm not sure, but I give it a 15%, 20% shot that by fasting here I'm going to cause harm to my body or get sick. Now, where does that come from? Like, the doctor's opinion can be a source of that fear of harm. So, for example, I go for a checkup. The doctor tells me that, I'm not telling you that fasting is going to kill you. But it's not good for you because of your diabetes situation. Now, based on what he says or she says, that I take them to be somebody who is an expert in this field, and I now within me a certain probability arises that fasting is going to cause harm to me. In that case, then I rely on the doctor's opinion. But let's say a doctor tells me something, and I know for sure that this is something that is not going to cause me harm. I'm certain the fasting won't be an issue for me. In that case, I must fast. Another situation where somebody is exempted from fasting is if they're elderly and fasting is extremely difficult or impossible. For an elderly person, as soon as they understand that fasting is something which is difficult for them, meaning that it causes a lot of extreme difficulty, or it's something which is impossible for them to do, then they're exempted from fasting. And in that situation, then the consequence, there's some consequence that will be described in the upcoming slide. We'll talk about it after a few slides, inshallah. The next situation is when a woman is expecting a child. Now, in this situation, if she has certainty, or if it's not certainty, but she gives probability, okay, and this probability is based on rational grounds, for example, the doctor's opinion, or whatever it is, right? If there's a chance that fasting will harm her or the child, okay, it would cause some sort of harm, all right? Then in that case, fasting is not obligatory. Now, if this harm is dangerous, according to Ayatul Sistani, then it's prohibited. According to Ayatul Khamenei, if there's any harm, either to herself or to the child, then fasting is prohibited. Now, let me give you an example of that. Somebody, a lady who is expecting, goes for an ultrasound, and then she's told by the doctor that, look, growth is not the way that we want to see it. You have to be eating frequent meals in order to ensure proper growth for your child. Now, in this case, it's very clear, because fasting will be a source of harm to the child, and therefore she's not allowed to fast in this situation. Now, if this is the case, and a woman is not fasting because of what we talked about, then if she's close to delivery, then she owes a qada for missing that fast, and also fidya. And we'll explain more about what fidya is later on. And if she is not close to delivery, then she owes a qada, meaning that she has to make up that fast. Now, one note here is that if there's a expecting mother, and it's not a matter of harm, meaning that she's perfectly fine and fasting is not affecting her health, she's certain that it's not affecting her child's health as well too, there's no issue of harm being affected, then she has to fast. There's no exemption from her fasting in that situation. Now, another situation is where a woman is breastfeeding her a child and her milk supply is low. In this situation as well, if she knows, thinks, or fears, based on rational grounds, that fasting will harm her or the child's health, then fasting is not obligatory. Now, in this situation, according to Ayatul Sistani and Imam Khomeini and Ayatul Khamenei as well too, it's ihtiyat wajib, meaning that it's wajib based on ihtiyat that if there's an alternative which is available, then she has to use it. Now, if that alternative will in turn cause harm to the baby, then of course, then she wouldn't have to use that alternative. And in this situation, then she would owe qada and fidya as well too. And we'll talk more about qada and fidya. Are there any questions until now on any of these issues? I know that on the issue of the woman who's expecting and the breastfeeding, there's usually questions. If there are any, please go ahead and ask them. Continue then. We mentioned that regarding ihtiyat wajib, okay, there's a question. So let me go ahead and start explaining that if there's any questions about that. What is meant by it? So what we mentioned on this slide right here is ihtiyat wajib for her. Okay, thank you for the question. I meant to actually mention that, but it slipped my mind. Ihtiyad al-wajib means that what it means from our perspective as people who do taqleed of a marja means that these maraji have their understanding of what our practical responsibility is in this case is that it's wajib to do whatever is said here. So it's wajib in this case to find an alternative if available. So, for example, let's say that I don't know if this arises in our society right now, but let's say that back in the days where they had wet nurses available, right? You could give your child to another lady to feed. If such an alternative were available, and if there's a woman who fears her milk supply is low because of fasting, then she would have to, and that was an alternative which is available, then she would have to use that alternative and get a wet nurse to feed the baby during the month of Ramadan. But the ihtiyat part here means that the marja is saying that, look, this is the best understanding I could come up with, but if you want, you can refer to another marja who has a fatwa on this issue, and you can follow their opinion. According to these both of these marjas that we're presenting their viewpoints today, you have to go based on who's a'lam. Meaning that, let's say that you believe that Ayatollah Sistani is the most a'lam. Let's say, okay, and let's say that you believe Ayatollah Khamenei is number two and another Ayatollah is number three. Then if Ayatollah Sistani says Ihtiyat al-Wajib, you can refer to Ayatollah Khamenei as number two, for example, and you can see what he says on the issue. If he says Ihtiyat al-Wajib, then you can go to number three. Now if number three says that, you know what, you don't have to consider an alternative, then you can follow that opinion. Okay, I hope that's clear in terms of Ihtiyat al-Wajib. Basically it means that you can refer to the opinion of the next most learned scholar, and see if they have an opinion, a fatwa on this issue. If they also say ihtiyat, then you can go to the next and the next after that. Okay, there's a couple of questions. Is formula an alternative? Now, if somebody can use formula and they don't consider this formula as being harmful to their child, meaning that according to the normal understanding of people in the society, then that this would not cause harm to the child, then that would be wajib for them to do if they're following what we said here. They're not referring to the opinion of another marja. But if normally using formula is considered harmful to the health of the child, then when milk is an alternative, then they wouldn't be able to use formula in that case. Okay, and according to my understanding here, now this is everyone has to come up with their own understanding. According to my understanding, what the medical research, what the understanding right now is that formula is not an alternative for the breast milk, and actually using that when breast milk is available is something which is harmful to the health in the long run. Okay, so in that case, the formula would not be a necessary alternative to consider. Okay, there was a question about, if somebody has a disease and they're concerned that fasting will make them weak or sick. Now, they're not 100% sure. We didn't say that you have to have 100% conviction that fasting will make you sick. Even if you think that it will, or even if you have a probability, meaning that 15% chance, and that probability is based on rational grounds, then that would be enough to make it fasting not an obligation on you. Okay. Okay. So I think that I've answered the questions that have been posed. If there are any questions as we go along, please go ahead and type them. Inshallah, we'll continue now. Now, am I allowed to travel during the month of Ramadan? We said that one of the conditions for fasting being an obligation is that somebody should not be a traveler. We said that we'd explain in more detail. Let me go through in a little bit more detail now. Fasting is allowed during the month of Ramadan. Traveling is allowed during the month of Ramadan. Even though we know that when we're traveling, in some cases, then we can't fast. Even if we're traveling for the purpose of escaping from fasting, that's also something which is valid as well too. Okay, I did change the slides. If it hasn't updated, it should be updating soon, inshallah. The slide should say, am I allowed to travel during the month of Ramadan? Are people seeing that? Okay, so I got a resounding no. Let me try to figure out why this is the case. Okay, now are you able to see the slides now? The slides should say, am I allowed to travel during the month of Ramadan? Are you able to see it? Yes, no? Yes, okay, alhamdulillah. Okay, great. There was a question about using asthma puffers, and the answer is yes, you are allowed to use them while fasting. Okay, and that's something we'll cover, inshallah, when we're talking about those things that invalidate the fasting. Okay, great. Now, am I allowed to travel? Yes, I am, even though it's going to cause me to not be able to fast, even though it's for escaping fasting as well, too, that's allowed. So if it's something which is halal, then in some cases there might be a situation where we need to make use of that, even if it's for that purpose as well too. But we should mention that it is ihtiyat al-mustahab, meaning it's recommended for a traveler, even if somebody's traveling and even if they don't have to fast, it's still recommended for them to stay away from food, drink, and sexual intercourse during the daytime of the month of Ramadan. Now, if I do travel, okay, if I'm a traveler, I am exempted from fasting, and my fasting is invalid. It's not like I don't have a choice here. It's not like, okay, well, if I want to fast, I can fast. No, it's just not valid. Unless one of these is present. That one of them is that I'm planning on staying in a place for 10 days or more, meaning I'm setting up in camp in some town for 10 days or more. Or I'm considered to be a frequent traveler. Or the travel is sinful. Okay. Now, what does it mean to be a frequent traveler? In this regard, like there's some details, and inshallah, time permitting, in tomorrow's presentation, I would like to mention a little bit more about that. But I should mention here that this is like what may qualify somebody as a frequent traveler. It's not just something that is purely dependent on, you know, what people would say in the society. No, like the Maharaja have specified criteria. For example, Ayatollah Sistani says that if somebody is a traveler or in a state of traveling for 10 or more days in a month, and they are continuing in this situation for 6 months out of a year, or for 3 months out of a year, but for two or more consecutive years, meaning that, you know, they're in that state of traveling like for a few months of the year for a couple of years, then they would be a frequent traveler. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, it's different. For example, he says that you become a frequent traveler if it's for work purposes, not for other purposes. And the criteria that he specifies is also a little bit more different as well too. Because this is an issue that people ask about a lot, just in my own experiences I've seen, inshallah, I hope that I can cover it tomorrow, because it's not directly related to fasting, then it's something that I won't, if we don't get time, then I won't mention it. There's a question about blood tests while fasting. If the blood is withdrawn from the body, at least according to Ayatollah Sistani, there's no issue with that. If it's a matter of blood being taken out, then according to Ayatollah Sistani and Ayatollah Khamenei, there's no issue at all. So that's not an issue. Yeah? Unless you know, somebody fears harm and or sickness or weakness because of doing that, meaning that it's like a major, major blood being taken out. But if it's just a blood test, no, that's not an issue. Okay. Now, let's say that what if your trip is a house hunting? Okay, if you can explain more, inshallah, I'll continue talking as you're explaining. Okay, I'll get to the questions just a bit. I must keep my fast if I travel and I cross the city boundary of my hometown after Dhuhr. If I'm traveling, right, and I'm leaving the city boundary of my hometown after Dhuhr. Okay, meaning that, let's say I live in Smallville, all right, and Smallville has a certain city boundary, right, which is like 5 miles away from home. If I'm crossing that after Dhuhr time, then I have to keep my fast. Okay, as I'm leaving now, I'm leaving the town, or I'm flying past that. Okay, if it's, I have to look at the time and just check it when I'm leaving that city boundary. I've been traveling, now I'm coming back home, and I cross into the city boundary of, let's say, Smallville, and in my hometown or place of temporary residency before Dhuhr, and I haven't committed any act that would break a fast. In that case, I would have to also keep my fast. Meaning, I entered, it's like 11 o'clock, I've been on a trip, I end up back home at 11 o'clock in the morning, I haven't done anything to break my fast. In that case, I have to keep the fast, I have to make the niyyah, I have to keep the fast when I'm entered into town. Let's say that somebody has, let's say like I'm flying into town, right? It's a month of Ramadan. At 9 o'clock in the morning, you know, I have breakfast on the plane because I'm a traveler. I'm allowed to do that. And then 11 o'clock, I end up crossing into the city boundary and enter into town. Now, in this situation, I would not be able to keep that fast, obviously, because I've invalidated the act of fasting, but it's mustahab to still refrain from food for the rest of that day, food and drink and other acts, and I would have to do qada. I would have to do qada later on. Okay. Now, I'm allowed to break my fast when traveling. Let's say I'm planning on traveling today. Let's say I wake up in the morning. I know I'm traveling at like say 10 in the morning. Okay. I do have to keep the fast until 10 in the morning, and but as soon as I begin my travel and I've gone past what's called the had at-tarakhus, all right, at that situation, at that point, I'm allowed to now break my fast. Okay, and of course, this is when I'm intending to travel the required distance, which is 22 kilometers, approximately 22 kilometers away from the city border. So it shouldn't be the case that, okay, because I know I have a flight, let's say 11 o'clock in the morning. I wake up at 8 o'clock, it's a month of Ramadan. I'm like, well, because I'm traveling and I'm traveling far away, then I don't have to fast today. No. Until I've actually crossed the Had at-Tarakhus, in that situation, that's when I can break my fast. Now, what is the Had at-Tarakhus? It's not just the city boundary, it's where a traveler has gone far enough to be hidden from the sight of city dwellers, wherever that would be. Let's say it's I don't know, a mile out, or whatever it would take to be hidden from the sight of city dwellers. If somebody's like watching us travel, then they will be able to see us. I should make a note. Let me just go back to the slide before here, where I said the city boundary of my hometown after Dhuhr. Just to be technically precise here, this is according to the ruling of Ayatollah Sistani. I wasn't able to completely confirm. Fully confirm what the ruling is according to Ayatollah Khamenei on this particular issue, and I'm waiting for a confirmation from them on exactly what is it, the city boundary, or is it when I leave my home, or is it when I pass Had at-Tarakhus? What is it? When do I have to check the time and see whether it's Dhuhr or not? So that one I'm still waiting for an answer on. Okay. Now, what is considered the city boundary? That is another issue about normally, yeah, it's considered like whatever the urf, whatever would normally be considered the city boundary, but in large cities, what's like very very large cities or city areas where everything is one city, it may be something which is a smaller breakdown. For example, one area of that large city where somebody would normally be considered as a traveler, even if they were to leave this one area, even though they're within that one big city. So the issue, this particular issue of big cities and the issue of frequent traveler, those are issues which are definitely important. Inshallah, if we have time tomorrow, we'll cover those issues in more detail. So if I'm moving in the month of Ramadan, I'm traveling to my new home, during the course of that travel, then yes, I would be a traveler, of course, if the other conditions are in place, if there's enough of a distance involved when I'm traveling. When I actually arrive there, then if I'm going to be staying there for 10 or more days, then of course, then I would have to fast. But let's say I'm not. I'm planning on being there and just like going for a week and then coming back again. Yes, even though that is going to be my hometown, it does take a bit of time before a hometown is established as a hometown, and I can count it as such. And therefore, if I just got there and I'm not planning on spending that much time there, I'm just spending a week there and coming back again, then I would be considered a traveler, even though it's my new home, because I haven't been there long enough for it to be established as my hometown. If anybody has particular questions about that, they should email me or talk to me after the presentation. What about small, frequent shots like allergy shots? There's no problem in those, but there are some. Generally speaking, there are some conditions on that. When we get to that section, inshallah, you'll see those conditions. Okay. Let's move on. Now, those who making up qada fasts. So, a few rules about qada fasts. So, let's say, first of all, making up qada in general, right, is an obligation that we have, and it's important that we treat it as an obligation. We should be serious about that. As a believer, we need to be making up for the past wrongs that we've done, whether they be to people or we've done dhulm in our relationship to God, and we've wronged ourselves when it comes to our relationship with Him. He asked us to do something, we didn't do it. Or we weren't able to do it, but we know that we have to do qada. So one thing that we need to do is we need to understand how much qada we have. Now let's say that I'm unsure from the past years, and something is between two numbers. In that case, the lower bound, like for example between 10 and 15, 10 would be wajib on me to make up. Now, do I have to make up? Let's say that right now it's the last month, days of Sha'ban. I have qada fasts that I know I have to make up. Is it wajib on me to make them up before the next month of Ramadan? According to Ayatollah Sistani, it's mustahab to make them up, meaning that it's recommended. According to Imam Khomeini and Ayatollah Khamenei, it's ihtiyat-e wajib, meaning that it is an obligation if you follow their ruling, but you can refer to the next most learned marja and refer to their opinion if you like on this issue. Meaning that you have to do it. So in either case, it's a serious issue. We should take it as something serious. Whether or not whether you're following Ayatollah Sistani or Ayatollah Khamenei on this issue, if the next month of Ramadan comes about and I haven't made it up, okay, fidya will be wajib as well too. Now, I should say that there's some caveats here that I'll explain a little bit later, but fidya can become wajib, or it will normally become wajib as well too. For example, if in Ramadan of 1433 last year I missed a fast due to illness, now I was able to make it up before Ramadan starts next week. Let's say like tomorrow, you know, there's no reason why I can't make it up, but I just don't do it. In that case, then I still owe the qada for that fast, but I also owe fidya as well for the delay in making it up. Okay, now what fidya is, how much it is, inshallah, we'll cover later. There's some people who don't have to give qada for missing a fast. One of them is a non-believer. If there's somebody who has reverted to Islam, is a converted to Islam, they don't have to make up fasts for those months of Ramadan, those days of Ramadan that they were not Muslim. A mustabsir, somebody who became Shia from another madhab, if they were fasting according to that madhab's rulings and now they became a Shia, now of course they have to follow our rulings, but in the previous fast, as long as they were holding themselves to the previous madhab's ruling, then the fast is valid. And this is a very it's an interesting ruling, and it shows us something about the tolerance within Islam, and also the acceptance, and it's a point of unity as well too. Anyhow, one who experiences periods of insanity is exempt from and they're not able to fast because of that, they don't have to make up the fast. Now, one who misses a fast due to illness and stays ill to the next Ramadan. Let's say I have some sickness where, you know what, it's like a few years where I haven't been able to fast. I don't have to worry then about the qada for those fasts as long as the illness lasted the whole year. I do owe a fidya, as we'll explain a little bit later. But let's say, no, I was ill and I got better and I was able to make up the fast. At that point, then I would have to... I do have to do that qada. Now, a little bit more details about what we owe if we're not able to fast. First of all, if somebody is a nursing mother, we talked about this, not every nursing mother, but a nursing mother who fears on account of harm due to low milk supply, either for herself or for her child. If she's not going to fast, if fasting is invalid for her, then she has to do qada when she can. And she has to do fidya as well, which we'll explain in more detail, but it's basically giving 750 grams of food stuff to a poor person. Okay, like wheat or like or pasta or something, which like 750 grams of food. An expecting mother who is at the daily fidya, this is for one fast. For one fast that she misses, then she has to do a fidya of 750 grams of food as well. Expecting mother who doesn't fast and she's near to delivery, she doesn't fast on account of harm that she fears for her child or for herself. In that case, again, she has to do qada and fidya. And somebody who is sick, somebody who is a traveler, a woman who is in the state of hayd or nifas, after the condition passes, then they have to do qada, but they don't have to do a fidya. So let's say I travel, I take a trip, a business trip, I go off for a week, and I come back. So now I have seven, and it's during the month of Ramadan, I have seven fasts to make up, I don't have to do fidya. But now, if you see here in the right hand side of the slide, if I don't make up the qada before the next Ramadan, then I do have to do a fidya for the delay. Now there's a star here on the no. And the reason for that is that there's a difference of opinion here between Ayatollah Khamenei and Ayatollah Sistani. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, if, let's say that I have to do a qada, but I'm not able to, I have a valid reason for not being able to make up that qada. For example, I've been traveling, right? Like, let's say I was sick for 10 months, and then for like the month of Sha'aban, I was traveling the whole month. In that situation, I wasn't able to make it up. In that case, I have a valid reason. I don't have to do fidya. I just have to do that. I still have to make up that qada in the next year, then after the month of Ramadan. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, if the reason for the delay, if there's a valid reason, it's not because of just negligence. In that case, I don't have to do fidya. According to Ayatollah Sistani, he says that no. If you have to make up the qada, but you didn't do it for the next Ramadan, then you'd have to do a fidya. So, for example, if there is a woman who is nursing and she doesn't fast because of the reasons that we mentioned earlier, now she has to do qada. Now, let's say she doesn't do the qada until then the next month of Ramadan comes up, right? In that case, then if she's not able to make up the qada, then, or she doesn't do it, right? According to Ayatollah Sistani, she will owe the qada still, you know, in the next year. And she owes two fidyas. One for missing the fast on account of suspected harm to her child, and one for the delay as well. Okay? So if there's any questions about that, then please let me know. Let me just pause. There's a question I missed. Yes, okay, yes. If you are expecting and you don't fast because of that, and then you delay making the qada until the next year, according to Ayatollah Sistani, then you owe two fidyas. One for the, because you didn't fast on account of suspected harm or to the child, and one for the delay as well too. Exactly. But then that's it. That you don't owe another fidya for the next year or anything if you don't do it for the next year. Okay, any other questions? Okay, we'll just go on for a couple more minutes, inshallah, and then we'll pause for today. I'll open up for any other questions, and we'll pause. Those who have to give fidya but no qada, if somebody is elderly, we talked about two situations in the slide earlier. One was a situation where they're elderly and it's difficult for them to fast. Another one is where it's impossible for them to fast. If it's impossible for them to fast, then they don't have to do qada and they don't have to do any fidya as well too. They're scot-free. Okay, if it's difficult for them to fast, then they don't have to do qada, but they do have to do fidya. Although there's a point here that Abdul Khamenei says, which is that if there's an elderly person who regains the ability to fast, it's ihtiyat-e wajib for them to make up the fasts that are missed. Okay? Now, if somebody is ill and the illness lasts till the next Ramadan, then they don't have to make up the fast, but they do have to do pay the fidya. Okay, I mean that like. They were ill. They weren't able to make up the fast for the entire year. Okay, the qada is no longer there for them, but they do have to pay the fidya. Okay, about fidya. Fidya is one mud, which is 3/4 of a kilogram of food. And it's better to give wheat to a poor Muslim Shia. Now, Shia here, this is according to Ayatollah Sistani. I wasn't able to confirm the Shia part according to the fatwa of Ayatollah Khamenei. This is something that I asked. I wasn't able to. I'm still waiting the response on that issue. Now, this is different than just feeding somebody a meal. I can't just say, okay, I'm going to make somebody who's hungry, let me just give them a meal and make them full. No, in this case, the fidya, what we're talking about here is 3/4 of a kilogram of food. And you can give fidya for multiple days to one person. Okay, now this is different than the kafara, if somebody doesn't fast knowingly, intentionally, that one is different to the 60 poor people. We'll talk about that inshallah tomorrow. It must be delivered as food, not as money to buy food. There's an exception that I mentioned for Ayatollah Khamenei, where let's say that there's a poor person and I can trust them, I can make them my appointed trustee, I can give them the food and say, look, you're my trustee, go and buy food for yourself, that's okay. I can't appoint a wakil, like a trusted charity, to take this money and distribute, meaning that they'll take money from me and they'll buy the food and they'll distribute it. But I have to make sure that they're trusted and they'll do it. And it doesn't need to be given right away, but it shouldn't, I mean, it's not wajib to, like, you know, as soon as I know I have to give food, I have to give it. But I shouldn't leave it aside so long that it becomes an act of negligence towards the law of God. Okay? Alright, now when do I fast, inshallah? We'll cover that starting. That'll be the first thing we cover tomorrow, inshallah. I want to pause here, see if there's any questions, and then we'll end up, inshallah, for today's presentation. There was a question about, does the fast begin at... at Imsak or Fajr time? Okay, I'm going to stop the screen sharing, because the presentation... has stopped, but I'll stay online still. I'll be answering the questions. Okay. Does the fast begin at Imsak or Fajr? The fast begins at Fajr time. Imsak, as you find on timetables, what Imsak means is basically refraining from. Okay, and what's meant is refraining from those things which are prohibited when one is fasting. And usually on timetables you'll see a column where they indicate the time of Imsak, and that's a few minutes before Fajr. That's based on precaution. And it has to do with the uncertainty regarding regarding exactly when the Fajr is, meaning that usually it's just an approximation of when the Fajr is. So the people who make the timetables, if they're trusted people, they'll know that they have a margin of error. So they say, okay, well, in order to be sure that you're going to start fasting at the time of Fajr, then start at this Imsak time, meaning that this is the time that you will you should refrain from eating or drinking, or the other things that are mentioned as prohibitions while fasting. The Fajr time then is the time that you can be sure that Fajr has set in and you can start praying. So it's a matter of precaution. And we'll talk about that more inshallah tomorrow. What happens if you have to take medication but there's no time just before Fajr and the medication is a must? Well, in that case, fasting is going to cause harm to you because you're not taking your medication. Therefore, fasting is invalid. For that day, you will have to go ahead and take the medication, and you will do qada later on then, if it's possible to do qada. Now, there's a question: they don't have to make up the fast for just for that year, or for good. If meaning that if somebody is sick, and they remain sick until for the entire remainder of the year until the next Ramadan, then that's it. Like, they don't have to make up that fast period. But they do have to do fidyah, as we mentioned. Okay. Why can't the fidyah be a meal? The requirement is that it has to be 750 grams of food. So if you give that in the form of a meal, that's fine. But if I just give a meal and I just say okay, that's not enough. I mean, just to say okay, feed somebody until they're hungry, because that might not fulfill the obligation. Is it okay to give fidyah in advance? Well, that doesn't really apply here, because fidyah is something that happens after the consequence, right? I mean, meaning that if I'm not able to fast, then, for example, then that's when, for whatever reason, I'm not able to fast the ones that I mentioned, then fidyah might become obligatory on me. So that's when I have to give fidyah. But let's say that, okay, that there's an expecting mother, and she knows that from before the month of Ramadan that this is going to happen, she's not going to be able to fast during this month because it's of feared harm to her child. Then in that case, she can send the money to a wakil, like a trusted person, for example, or she can give it to a trusted person and tell them to, after the fact, after the time period, then they can, you know, they can turn that into the fidyah for her, the 750 grams of food for her, and she can make the niyyah at that time. So it's okay to send the money from beforehand as long as the niyyah is going to be changed afterwards. But it's not okay to distribute the food from beforehand, because there's no obligation until it actually takes place and somebody doesn't fast when this thing applies. Okay, what if you did not know about past fidyas and make up all your qada days in the past? Do you have to go back and pay fidyah? Yes, if fidyah was wajib on you, and you still know it's wajib on you, then there's no expiration of fidyah. Fidyah is an obligation, and it's still there then. How do you choose a wakil or a trusted charity? This is somebody that you can do research on. One of the charities that I personally know about is Comfort Aid. Comfort Aid is run by actually my uncle, and I'm not saying it because of nepotism. I'm just saying it's somebody that I know and trust, and I've seen the work that they do firsthand, and what I've seen is selfless efforts, and they can do this as well too. If you contact them, you say this is what you need to do, they'll tell you what the amount is that's required as well. If somebody continues to eat during the imsak time, is that a sin? If somebody, basically we need to, we'll talk about this more tomorrow inshallah, but just because it was asked, let me mention as briefly, that we have to understand, like, this timetable that we're getting, what does it tell us about the Fajr time? Like, if they're telling us that, if we're understanding from this, like, you to see what sort of understanding we're getting from the timetable, is it that they're telling us that, look, it, our calculations are not precise, right? The Fajr time I'd like to explain this in a little bit more detail, because it's not a simple question. Inshallah, I'll cover that tomorrow in the slide. If there's any questions, if you're not going to be participating tomorrow and you want the answer to this, then please go ahead and send an email to the academy, and inshallah I'll respond over email exactly what I respond. I want to be precise and make sure I give you the right answer, and right now we don't have that. We're actually out of time. I don't want to answer that right now. Just for clarification, does a woman owe fidyah if she does not fast at any time during pregnancy, or does she owe fidyah only if she misses at the beginning of pregnancy? A woman owes fidyah if she doesn't fast and she's in the late stage of pregnancy, she's close to delivery, in that situation, and she fears on account of her child that's in the womb, that's when she owes a fidyah. But otherwise, if she doesn't fast, like let's say it's the beginning of her pregnancy, she doesn't fast because of sickness or because of harm, feared harm to herself, then she doesn't own fidya. The fidya can be given to a poor person, or can be, it has to be given to a poor person. Okay, and that poor person cannot be somebody who is wajibun nafaqa, meaning somebody who is a dependent on you and is wajib on you to support them. Okay. Thank you very much for participating on this seminar. Inshallah, we will be back online tomorrow. The slides, the copy of the slides, inshallah, they will be uploaded to the Academy's website. And inshallah, you'll be able to find a link there. And hopefully, we'll try to get them to you in time so that you can take notes for tomorrow. If there's any questions, in the meantime, if you can email them from beforehand, that would be good, so then we can incorporate them into the slides. There is a lot more to cover. I'm concerned about our timing for tomorrow. So if we can, if I can just incorporate it into the slides, inshallah, then I can try to go a little bit faster tomorrow. So thank you, and please keep us in your dua. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.